And I decided in consultation with several members of the Sangha to shift my topic, actually. I think we can come back to the one that I was going to do. I had suggested focusing on the polarization of views and how to work with that sort of a dimension of working with speech practice and working with differences and even conflicts. And in talking with people from the Sangha, and also just reflecting on some of my own experience, particularly being with people with whom I work one-on-one. I work one-on-one probably with, I don't know, probably 40 to 50 people a month. And typically once a month, sometimes a little bit less frequently. And in considering what I had been experiencing and what people were experiencing also in relation to the world and the fairly extreme events happening, that I thought to focus more on practicing with challenges, how to practice with challenges, whether they're personal or collective or a mix of the two. And so that's what I'll explore and look at the different ways that our practice can be helpful in that. And it's been a little bit uncanny in talking with people with whom I work. I believe that what I have experienced with people in the last 10 days has involved more reports of very intense difficulties than I can ever remember. I don't, you know, I'm not a proponent particularly or well studied in astrology, but something is up. How many people have a sense that something is up, right? Whether, you know, whether it's the, whether it's more personal or whether it's the, collective shock of some of the events happening, you know, whether, you know, probably particularly for people, the fires in California, the sense that this is not a temporary event to have such fires, and that there's some seeing of what had been, I don't know if prophesied is the word, but had been identified as likely by scientists for many years. And so just being aware of that, sometimes it's more intense for younger people, really wondering about a stable future, about a stable planet. You know, in the context of far from adequate action by the political leaders all around the world. So it can be that, it can be the shocking events in Afghanistan. Maybe just reflecting on the, you know, depending on one's perspective, on different dimensions of the craziness of foreign policy. You know, why did we invade Afghanistan? I think there were reasons given at the time, but there, I think there was one person who voted against the financial support of that, who happens to be my congressperson, Barbara Lee. So it may be maybe those events or the events in Haiti or the continued intensification of COVID, right? How long can we be with events that are quote unquote not normal and have some degree of disequilibrium or find equanimity harder or be shaken in some way? And there, yeah. And then I was mentioning very, quite surprising for me to see some of what I heard from people with whom I work. People talking, for example, about the possibility of a decades-long marriage ending, or deep anguish about relationships with children, or an injury, a very bad injury to a 94-year-old father, or a sister in her late 60s being diagnosed with Alzheimer's, right? Or even in among people who are close to me, hearing stories of people not agreeing to get vaccines and leading people with whom they're in contact actually to become sick. And others refusing to get vaccinations, and also one person refusing even to get health care. Not a great combination, right? And so just, the anguish within the people who are close to these people, I'm just naming. Other people being evacuated for the fires, or being on warning for that. Some people I know going through something like what we could call a dark night of the soul. You know, some of you know that term from St. John of the Cross from the 16th century, Juan de la Cruz, who spoke of the dark night of the soul as a time when one is disoriented. And he saw it actually as only occurring to spiritually mature people. Maybe I could give a talk on that. I don't know if anyone's attended, but I've done two or three 2 and 3 day workshops on that topic. And maybe I could, how many would be interested in that as a theme for one of our evenings? Yeah. And so there are people going through that, which is, you know, and I'm in close touch with one person, and it's been going on for, you know, in some ways, moving out of it, but their process is still there, 2 years into the process. Right. And a researcher named Willoughby Britton, Britton, who's at Brown University, has actually been gathering stories of people who go through something like a dark night related to meditation. And she has quite a number of examples, and a lot of them last for one or more years, several years at times. And we could see even that the earth itself may be going through something like a collective dark night, where, so this is all sobering. And I wanted just to invite people to think of a challenge that may be there for you and see if you can describe it in one sentence, fairly brief sentence. And I want to invite people just to speak up and name something that's been challenging for you. Again, could be personal, could be collective, could be a mix, could be some other aspect. Anyone like to, you can use, I guess, I can, maybe with Corey, I think if you have your video on, and you raise your hand, I can see it. So anyone like to just share one sentence? And Corey, if you can go maybe to the second page, please, Nancy.
The death of my beloved husband.
Thank you. Others, please. Please, Deirdre.
Being with my adult son, who's going through stem cell therapy for cancer.
Liz, and then Nick.
Accepting old age and illness and death in the near future. I'm 82, working with that.
Nick, please. Unmute, please. Nick, you have to unmute first. You're still muted, Nick. Can Corey, can we unmute Nick for him?
Unfortunately not. And I think, Nick, didn't you call in as well on the phone? If so, you'll need to do it on the phone.
No, it doesn't look like a phone connection.
No, he's on both.
Okay. Okay. Others, please. Nancy.
Grief and sadness for our planet and for so many people in my life, friends and family.
Thank you. Vita, please.
The continued effects of my daughter's accident 2.5 years ago to her health.
Yeah, one or two more, if anyone would like to also share. Please, Marion, and then Linda.
Marion, I think you need to unmute.
Sorry. 30 years of an illness that's progressive and extremely painful, and I'm heading very near to a wheelchair very soon.
Thank you. The last one, Linda, please.
Questioning the value and the impact of my life.
Questioning the
value and the impact of the life I've lived.
Wow. Thank you so much. How many can relate to one or more of those challenges? Raise your hand. Maybe just to hold those. There's a lot there. So where I'll go with this is first to talk about community, to talk about, and then to give one of the helpful frameworks for working with challenges. And then lastly, to give kind of a compendium of ways of practicing. You know, tools we might use with any of these challenges. Although, yeah, a lot of these are quite intense. Some of you, you know, you've all probably heard me before and know that one of my starting points for working with challenges or difficult states is identifying the level of intensity, you know, from 1 to 10. And I think we have some 9s or 10s here, right? So it's a lot just to recognize that. I'll come back to that point. But first point is the value of community. And I was thinking of that, remembering a phrase that Joanna Macy once said. It was actually in conversation with me. We did a conversation, which we later published. And she talked about the value of what she called rough weather networks. Rough weather networks. Can one have a group, a community, which can be part of the set of resources when there are these challenges? It can look differently in different situations. In some ways, we have a community here, but again, for some of what was named, the dimension of community that might be most valuable might be 2 or 3 people, or might be could be a group focusing on a particular issue. But I think Joanna was particularly talking about almost like a network of friends, maybe like a smaller group, as opposed to, I mean, this is in some way, you know, a really valuable community, but there might be ones where the format is such that you could actually talk at length about what you're going through and get, you know, get other people's perspectives, supports, even in some situations, concrete help. So designing rough weather networks, is that something we want to give some attention to? It's like kind of like the counterpart of that making of emergency plans and having all your water and whatever it is, 2 days dried food. Has anyone done that? Yeah, some of you have. I've done it maybe 1/3 of the way, right? And that might be better than the average. But any case, having like a rough weather network, very crucial. I was also thinking of a statement that some of you know from Thich Nhat Hanh, who was reflecting, and he said, the next Buddha may not be an individual. The next Buddha may be a community. There may be a way that, I think it connects with the idea of a rough weather network, that awakening definitely occurs individually at times in our individual practice, but there are ways it can occur relationally or collectively as well. I think that's what he was getting at. The importance of deep sharing, deep practice in a community. Again, could be one other person, could be 2 other persons. I know I had once a really valuable group that just had 3 people, including myself. But we met regularly every 2 weeks for about a year, I think. And it was really, really crucial. And then there's the naming that there's a challenge going on. It could be the naming of reactivity, as we were exploring some last time, and as we explored to some extent in the guided meditation. Can I know when I'm in the midst of a challenge and there is some kind of reactivity happening? Can I know that there's a challenge and watch my tendencies, watch my mind? Can I make it practice? Can I be alert You know, one of the interesting models, which I don't think I've ever taught about here, is to what is the teaching of the eight worldly winds. How many have studied at some time the eight worldly winds? And I don't think I've taught it here, but I've sometimes taught it. And I think in my book, The Engaged Spiritual Life, I wrote about it some. But this is a teaching from the Buddha that can be helpful because it really names the sort of situations which will tend to be challenging or will tend to trigger reactivity. So having this list can be really, really helpful. So let's go, Corey, now with the screen share. The eight worldly winds, and the word wind is a liberal translation. The actual word is Dhamma, which probably more literally would be translated as conditions or maybe phenomena. And these are four sets of situations that tend to lead to challenge, sometimes to reactivity, to difficulty. Pleasure and pain is the more general of the sets, and the others in some way come under that rubric. So we want to look out for really pleasant situations or really difficult situations. There's nothing necessarily a problem with pleasure or pain, except as we know from the teaching from last time, when we're not mindful and when we have some residual ignorance, which is true for all of us, we will tend to grasp after the pleasant and push away the unpleasant. The second set relates to gain and loss. And these are taken to be the eight worldly conditions. These are taken to be experiences which naturally occur. They're pointed out in particular because, again, they tend to trigger some kind of reactivity or confusion. But they necessarily will come. Gain and loss, whatever we're looking at. Financial gain and loss of relationships. Can relate this to the way that everything ultimately is lost, you know, keeping impermanence in mind. The third is fame and disrepute, or you might say having others have a good image of oneself or a bad image of oneself. These will sometimes occur. They can be very difficult for us or disturbing. And related to that is the fourth set, praise and blame, which sometimes is the most intense of these. When we get praise, we like it so much. When we get blame, it can be deeply, deeply triggering, you know. And I know from the work on the judgmental mind that receiving blame can take us right back to being 4 years old or 5 years old, or take us back to some of the most difficult moments in our lives. So this is the Buddha's summary. These eight worldly conditions keep the world turning round. And the world turns around these eight worldly conditions. Which eight? Gain and loss, fame, disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. These conditions among human beings are in constant, impermanent, subject to change. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no reactivity. And again, we can let go of the screen share now. So just a few other words about these eight worldly winds. The first one, these are really ways to hold this. The first is that, again, the pleasant or the unpleasant in itself isn't the problem. It's how we relate to it. that's really, really crucial. You know, that pleasant things in life, pleasant tastes or sounds can be quite wonderful. But again, we can be prone to grasping. And it's something we can really study that. You know, meals are a great place to study it. And so again, the painful experience isn't necessarily the problem. Sometimes what's painful is there, and it's more a matter of being with it. You know, some of the situations which I mentioned and you mentioned are situations, and when there's in which there's something difficult, we could say painful physically or emotionally. And it's not a matter of getting rid of it. It's a matter of how to be skillful with it, how to be responsive. Another point is that even though in meditation, it can be very valuable just to be mindful of the pleasant and the painful, we're not talking about passivity. That a skillful response is actually right at the heart of all of this. And then the last sort of complexity of looking at these eight worldly winds is that often when we are reactive, when one of these eight worldly winds leads to reactivity, our reactivity may have some insight or truth or validity, as this makes things complicated. Right, that I might have negative thoughts about what someone said about me. I might become reactive, and yet there might be something problematic. Maybe the person wasn't respectful for me, or the person was being judgmental. You know, and I might notice something that's important to notice, particularly if we can talk together. You know, or I might have a loss that's related to something that wasn't fair, something that was unjust. And worst case scenario, I lose a job because of job discrimination of some kind. And I can be very reactive about that, but I might be tuning into something really important to notice. So that's really, you know, that's a point I continually make that makes all of this tricky, is that when I become reactive, my reactivity can often be a mix of, you know, sort of habitual reactivity with some kind of insight or noticing. And we have to disentangle those. You know, if I'm going to respond to something that was unfair about a job loss, I can be most skillful when I disentangle the reactivity from what I see that's quite important and clear. So that all being said, let me name, I think I have 10 different ways to practice with challenges. And some of them I'll just name, some of them I'll go into detail. So I'll be relatively brief with this. I think the first is to set the intention to bring practice to a challenge. Intention goes such a long way. You know, so again, this is dependent on mindfulness, naming that this is a challenge and setting the intention to be as skillful as possible. Sometimes when we're caught up in what's challenging, it'll be actually hard to have that intention. So finding ways to bring the intention to practice into the situation, that's number one. Number two, ground in community and connection. It goes back to what I was saying earlier. Find ways to hold the challenge with others as much as one can. That's the second. The third is something I mentioned earlier. Assess the level of challenge, or maybe the level of reactivity or the level of intensity, maybe it's a broader way to say it, assess the level of intensity of the challenge. And know that for challenges of level 6 or 7, we may use different tools than challenges for levels 9 and 10. When something is most intense, we may simply want to do that which helps us stay in balance. You know, it could be not, you know, not even directly being mindful, not bringing elements of investigation to the challenge. But when we have a 9 or a 10, it may be to maybe to hold it with compassion or kindness, or be with others, or do something physical, work on the somatic level. So to have in one's repertoire responses to challenges that one uses when they're 9s or 10s, and other responses when they are 5s or 6s or 7s. Could be the same challenge. Sometimes it's a 9 or a 10, sometimes it's a 6 or 7, depending on the circumstances. And so when things are more in the workable range, maybe 5 or 6 or 7, we can bring in our mindfulness practice. Very crucial. We can stay with the experience of the challenge. We can name it. We can be present with it. We can remember that the aim of our practice is skillful response. It's not to get rid of the challenge. There'll be typically moments, at least, when we just want to get rid of the challenge. It's very understandable. We can know that that's not typically the most mature response. So we want to name that the challenge is happening. We can bring in some mindfulness. When the level of intensity is greater, we may want to, this is number 5, ground in the body. And I'm going to pack a lot into what I'm calling the 6th, which is to investigate one's experience of the challenge. And this is probably at the heart of our practice. Be with the emotions, be with the bodily experience when it's in the workable range. This is not always possible. When it's maybe 5 or 6 or 7, it becomes workable. And then we can be with the emotions. You know, when we do this, we can get very familiar, for example, with fear or anxiety about what's happening. And we want to, if possible, find times when that's workable, when we can be with fear or anxiety, be mindful, investigate it, what's it like in the body, stay with the emotion, stay with it for a while. Similarly, with other challenging emotions like anger, study anger, study sadness, study grief. Maybe in a discussion, we can talk more about these. They'd be worthy of, a session or sessions in themselves. Watch especially when we're investigating our experience with a challenge, watch especially for negative narratives. This is huge, right? We will tend to have a negative narrative. We will tend to tell a scary story to ourselves. How many in the challenges that you were thinking of noticed yourself sometimes telling yourself scary stories? They can look around, very, very common. And one of the most powerful aspects of our practice is identifying those stories, knowing that we're doing that. And when we know them well enough, having the intention, when we notice them, not to give them energy. That's huge for these challenges. Number 7, we can bring in wisdom teachings. Remember the teachings of the 8 worldly winds. Remember the teachings of reactivity. Remember the teachings of the 2 arrows, which says that when we have something difficult happen, we will tend to shoot a second arrow at ourselves or others. That could be through the negative narrative. You want to watch those carefully. Number 8, bring in regularly heart practices, metta, compassion, forgiveness, the crucial role in challenging situations of heart practices. Again, we could have a session just on how we bring heart practices into challenges. That's number 8. Number 9, this maybe is related to the teachings, but remember that our aim is awakening. Our aim is to touch love, deep wisdom, a powerful awareness that connects all of us. Our intention is to awaken. Can you tell yourself in the middle of a challenge, my aim is awakening? And probably we could bring in the 12-step line, for that we can fake it till we make it. Or we can say it, in other words, not 100% believing it. So remember awakening. And then last is bring all of this together and see what a skillful response is, or see what skillful responses are to the challenges. So maybe I'll just stop with that and maybe I'll read that line from the sutta on the 8 worldly winds to close. These 8 worldly conditions keep the world turning round, and the world turns around these 8 worldly conditions, which 8? Gain, loss, fame, disrepute, praise, blame, pleasure, and pain. These conditions among human beings are inconstant, impermanent, subject to change. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no reactivity. So let's just pause for a moment. See what resonated for you. See if there are any questions or anything you might want to share. Let's just take a moment to reflect. Let me invite anyone who'd like to share, ask a question, reflect on your own challenge, wherever you'd like to go. And again, I think we can just raise our hand. Not everyone has a video on, but if you do have your video on, looks like Patty wants to speak.
Thank you. I have a technical question. I seldom take notes, but I took notes when you were speaking, and I seem to have missed number 5. It went from 4 to 6.
Yeah, let's see. Number 5, let's see, I had number 4 as, I think I was not completely following my notes here. I had number 4 as name what's happening.
Thank you, I missed that. I got ground in the body as 4.
Yeah, ground in the body I have as 5. So name what's happening. It's an aspect of mindfulness, but the more sustained mindfulness I had under number 6. So
thank you.
I thought I'd stay with 10. It's generally been a good number in many cultures.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Heather, anyone want to share again somehow how you've worked with your challenge, what's been helpful, or a question? Again, you can just raise your hand. I can see people. And Corey, if you could be with the second page, as it were. Yeah, looks like Vita, then Corey.
I'm not sure, but when you're talking about the second error, somehow does that connect with reactivity?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I like to see the shooting at the second arrow as right at the heart of the definition of reactivity. In other words, for people who don't recall that teaching, it's that the Buddha said everyone experiences the unpleasant or the painful at times. What distinguishes someone who's practicing from someone who's not? And he says the non-practitioner tends to shoot a second arrow. He said feeling the original difficulty, pain, unpleasant experience is like being shot by an arrow. He says we shoot a second arrow as if that would help. You know, and so we may blame ourselves, blame someone else, tense in the body, you know, and so forth. And that is, I think, actually a definition of the reactivity in relationship to the unpleasant. Yeah, thank you. And it's such a crucial teaching. When I work one-on-one with people, the most common guidance that I give, this has been true over the years, is I might say something like, you're going through something difficult now. Watch out for the shooting of the second arrow. It's, in a way, it's that simple. You know, and then, you know, we can say more about that, but, you know, and I should say that I generalize reactivity to also mean the grasping after the pleasant. And so, but the Buddha was, in his text, was talking about the unpleasant. Thank you. Thanks, Vita. Corey, please.
So I was reflecting on how important practice is because when I'm going through something challenging, there's reactivity, but also there's the in the moment reactivity when something happens and it's like that, like the switch goes on. And I'm thinking like of road rage or something where somebody really triggers you in the moment.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering of the 10, I mean, I would think for me, I think that body, connecting to the body is one of the important ones in those moments of triggers. But I'm wondering of your list of 10, if you would recommend one or two or three more than the others for those instantaneous challenges.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a great question. Could be road rage, or it could be something that occurs in a discussion, in a group, and so forth, where one is triggered. I think there's a lot there, probably almost all of the resources that I named would be valuable. You know, for one, yeah, it would be, the starting point would be some kind of mindfulness, knowing what's happening, right? Unless you know what's happening, we can't really use a tool like grounding in the body. But yeah, once that occurs, we could say, you know, we want to get to the place that we go back to intention, bring practice in. What's a wise way to respond to the current moment? And we may have something that we do regularly with something like road rage. You know, I know, before the pandemic, when I was driving more, driving would sometimes offer opportunities for practice. Now I am deprived, because I only drive 10 miles a week. And it's mostly just to go to the swimming pool. And not that much happens. So anyway, but I would be driving and, you know, just the usual, someone cuts me off or is tailgating or something like that. And so I developed a practice to, if I notice myself reactive for a moment, to come right back with forgiveness practice. So you might have a general practice ready. Heart practices are really good. So I'm actually giving several of the 10 that I named. Heart practice to come back with being reactive, intention, ground in the body. Starting point has to be mindful so we know what's happening. You know, and then those are the first ones which come to mind. Probably we could apply some of the others too, but that's what comes to mind. Any others that you use, Corey?
No, those are great. Thank you. It's just, it's one of those things where, again, just having, when I practice more, they're more available. When I'm practicing less, they're less available.
Yeah. And so, you know, the example you gave, we can do things in the moment. And if there's a residue, you know, it might be like a difficult discussion with someone, you know, in one's family or coworker or a friend. And sometimes there are residues. And of course, you can come back and be with the emotions and the thoughts, you know, in practice, you know, in mindfulness and so forth. Maybe time for one more, if there is one. Please, Takako.
Yeah, kind of related to what Corey said, that I had an experience this Friday where I haven't talked to my ex-husband in a long time, but we have to talk regard to my son. Anyway, I had a series of just arrows coming. Of course, I reacted, so more arrow kept coming, and I just couldn't at all. None of these tools just, it didn't occur to me at all, I think, that, I mean, and I still haven't processed because it was just so terrifying.
Yeah.
And I basically decided, this is not good for me, just cut off is what I ended up thinking.
Yeah.
I'm still thinking like that. I mean, I would love to kind of sit with all these what happened, but I feel like it, and you're, you know, Oren likes to say, like, all these learning and all that. It's like when you deal with family, all these learning and practice just out the window because it's so much history happening and you don't know how, they know how to trigger you, right?
Yeah, that's right. They, they may be, the triggers may be mutually installed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Or I think Ramdas once said, you know, he said after, you know, he said this after 30 years of spiritual practice. Of course, with my family, my spiritual practice pretty quickly goes out the window. Right. So that can happen. And so, but it sounds like, you know, for you with that situation, you may not be talking so much to your former husband, but you could maybe go in, you know, next time knowing that it could be challenging. Go, you know, so that's where we bring in intention. And of course, you can be with what's there after the conversation, you know, be with it in practice and work with it and work with the reactivity, the emotions, the narratives and so forth. And one thing I didn't mention, I think I'll close with this, is that, not suggesting that this would have been possible for you, but one thing that I didn't mention that can be really, really helpful for challenges, when we have either in a family or in a couple or among friends, this would be actually to have agreements about what we'll do if we run into difficulties or challenges. You know, that can be incredible. You know, most of the groups I work with, we try to have some kind of guidelines, even if they're minimal. You know, when I taught two retreats recently on Buddhist practice and transforming racism, we had the group develop 23 guidelines that we worked with that we would often name at the beginning of a session. So that's something else to remember. When you're close to someone, especially if you share a practice, you can have a shared agreements on what you do when there are challenges. And that can be incredible. Because then if one person doesn't remember, a good chance the second will.